House Transportation Committee will come to order, and welcome everybody. Appreciate you coming. And the one member who could not quite make it over the pass, maybe he should have taken the train, right? With that, we're going to have an overview of the rail division with ODOT. So if Kelly Taylor, there she is. I'm thinking, I don't see her.
I think her name is actually on that seat back there.
Yeah.
You are a sick man.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor. I'm the Rail Division Administrator. And what I'd like to do today, I'm handing out testimony, and I'm going to speak to the topics, not necessarily the actual testimony itself, but leave that for your records. And I will refer to some of the attachments in the back. What I'd like to do today is give you an overview of my division and what we do with the rail industry and the community of interest around rail, and also just a brief overview of the rail itself in Oregon, although I know folks are coming up to speak specifically about their companies and their issues. I think it's kind of interesting. Rail, helped open up this country. As they built this country and it came west, it was railroads that helped open it up. And people actually built towns along the rail lines in order to, and if they weren't going to be along the rail lines, they moved to get next to the rail lines, So the rail has played a critical part in our past, and it plays a critical part today. It is an important part of the transportation system. I like to say no one mode can do it alone. You can't do it all by road. You can't do it all by water. You can't do it all by rail. They all have an integral part to play. And what we do in the rail division is we represent and advocate for the customers of rail, whether it be freight or passenger. I regulate the railroads, and I'm going to talk about that in detail. And we follow both state and federal regulatory authority. We have an authority under both federal reg and under state reg. So, rail regulations. Basically, since 1980, when what's known as the Staggers Act was passed by Congress, the rail industry was deregulated. And so rate and service issues, what they charge and how they serve, et cetera, that's been deregulated. That states are preempted from taking part in that. There is an oversight board called the Surface Transportation Board. It's a federal entity, and they hear rate and service issues of what does exist, what is left. What is left for the states to enforce, both from the federal side and the state side, are safety regulations. And the Federal Railroad Administration, which is part of USDOT, sets the standards and regulation for things like track, equipment, operating practices, things like that, signals at crossings. They also have the establishment of quiet zones. If train horns are not to be blown at all public crossings, a town can upgrade the crossings to a certain way to meet the FRA, that's their acronym, the Federal Railroad FRA's standards, and then not have to blow the horns at certain crossings. And there are towns around the state that are looking into that. Tualatin is looking into that for the commuter rail line right now. Now, what isn't covered by federal regs, then states may regulate themselves should they choose to do so. And Oregon has some laws on the books that are Oregon's that have to do with crossing regulations. And when I say crossings, that's the intersection of the railroad and the road, public crossings. And around walkways and clearances around rail lines to help protect the employees of the railroads. There's a certain amount of space as a train would go through a tunnel in case that train should be stuck in the tunnel to make sure that the employees can get back out, et cetera, and there's room. Or around in a rail yard, the surface and the space around that to, again, protect the employees. Now, our programs at the Rail Division as it pertains to all those regulations I just mentioned. We basically oversee the safety of about 2,500 public crossings in the state. The railroad and rail transit operations, that would be TriMet, Portland Streetcar, Willamette Shore Trolley, Astoria Trolley, and the development of freight and passenger rail opportunities, projects and things. I have three sections. I have a very small division. Out of all of ODOT, which is, 4,700 employees or so, I have 24 employees, including myself. So we're a pretty small division inside the department. But I have three sections. Crossing safety. Now, under Oregon law, the authority to regulate crossings in a uniform, consistent manner is vested exclusively with the Department of Transportation. And so what that means is when a road authority, a city, county, or state that has a road and they want to make a change and it's going to impact a crossing, they want to create a crossing, they want to put a road across tracks, or railroad, either one, railroads or road authorities, when they want to create a crossing, change a crossing as it exists, or close a crossing, they come to us for permission. But it's not permission like, oh, you fill out an application to get a fishing license, pay a fee, and you get it. It's a regulated process, and it's got legal steps that we go through. So when a railroad or a road authority comes to us and says, here's our application, we want to change something with crossing, blah, 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 we go through a legal process where we give both parties notice of the proposal. And typically there's been meetings ahead of time. And these things don't just pop up and hear the paperwork's first thing you see. There's usually been lots of conversations between the city and us or the railroad and us, and hopefully all parties have talked about it. They may or may not have agreed yet on what all the details are going to be, but they're aware of it. And somebody, one of the two parties, will submit the application to us. We actually begin what's known as a legal docket. We enter a docket, and it becomes a legal process. We give notice to the two parties. We hold a diagnostic evaluation of the crossing. We meet with the road authority. I'm going to just say city in this case, a city and the railroad. And we go out on site, and we meet, and we look at how many trains are there, how many cars are there, what the site distance is, just all of it. Everything about that crossing, and then what's being proposed. And then we try to figure out what our goal is to make it safe. And I will tell you that under state law, under state policy, the goal is to preferred to have separated crossings. In other words, something is either an over or an under crossing, an under and over crossing versus at grade where they touch. Because even though we can make at grade crossings safer, they're not as safe as being separated. You will have congestion there when cars have to stop. You will have people who will get antsy and want to go around the gates, or if there aren't gates, just go through the stop sign. People make poor choices sometimes. And so that's why the state law says to eliminate grade crossings whenever possible, and that is what we try to do. And I will tell you that when they apply and we work this out, we will issue what's known first as a proposed order. It's the proposal. Now, that by no means is going to happen. It is just that, a proposal. And the parties can object to it. Either party has the right to object to it. If we can't work it out, then we will set it for a hearing. And a party, if they get frustrated with the negotiations, can ask for it to be set for a hearing. You know, of all the ones we do, probably closing a crossing is the most sensitive, because it's a type of access to folks, and most people don't want to lose it. And yet there are reasons why you would close a crossing. It may be a very dangerous site. It may be there's accidents happening there. There may be just such a congestion of traffic that it's making it dangerous and you want to close it. It may be that we have some funds that we're applying towards another crossing, and in order to do so, to use those federal funds, you close a crossing to upgrade a crossing. And we have the funds to do that, and the city doesn't. And so as part of a bigger project, they'll say, if you'll help us upgrade this crossing, you know, we'll close this one, and they get to pick. And I will tell you that, you know, there have been some controversial ones, people that really get stirred up about it. But I will tell you the track record will tell you that it's a testament to the collaborative effort, that's what I'd say. When I look back over the last 10 years or so, and there's probably been a couple of hundred closures, only one, to my knowledge, has ever gone to a hearing, which means we've worked out all the other ones between the parties without going to a hearing. And I think that's a good thing. That means people are working together to find the solutions. And when that happens, when there's a potential change or whatever, again, that notice goes out. So if a city or a county or the state feels they need to do outreach to the citizens, if there's going to be a closure or something, it gives them time to do that. And, of course, like I said, issuing the proposed final order is not the first time anybody's ever heard of it. We've usually always worked with the city engineer, the public works person, the railroad, et cetera. And frequently, if someone comes to us and it's from a local government, and whether it's, and I'm going to digress, or passenger rail, commuter rail, whatever, the first thing I'm going to tell them is, have you talked to the railroad? because we want to make sure all parties are talking, not just one half doing something, having a conversation with us, and the other half not. So we try to get everybody in there and be inclusive about it. Now, we go out and inspect those 2,500 crossings. We go out, it takes us a couple of years to get through all of them. But once I've issued a crossing order, and that's the document, and it's got a capital O in the testimony because it's an actual formal document that's legally binding. That crossing order spells out to both parties what their responsibility is as far as installing whatever's happening, constructing whatever's happening, and maintaining it from here on out. And that's a legally binding document, enforceable in court, should either party not hold up their end of the agreement, until the very next crossing order. So it may be years and years and years before something ever happens to that crossing, but that order stays valid all of that time. It never expires until the next one's issued. And I will tell you that my department, my division has three key performance measures that the legislature has adopted, and one of them has to do with incidents at crossings. And I would say that, again, along with the fact that we rarely go to hearings on crossing issues, even though they can be contentious, that shows success. The fact is the incident numbers continue to decline each year at crossings in spite of increases in population, traffic, pedestrians, et cetera, and trains. So I think that speaks well to the fact that we're being successful with trying to protect the public. Because, frankly, and I will flip to a couple of the handouts here at the very, very, very back. You'll see some pictures. I'll hold up one of them. When there's a collision at a crossing, the train does not usually come out on the worst end of it. This particular picture that I'm showing you is from up in Marysville, Washington. And it's what happened was a semi-truck, which is fairly good size compared to a passenger vehicle, was going the same direction as the train. And clear back here in the picture, there's a crossing. They turned left in front of the train and got hit. And this Burlington Northern train came as much distance as you can see all the way out and finally derailed the impact. And that's the truck you see torn up there. And all the dirt, and it actually reached the roadway because the locomotive is about 75 foot long. So the point is you don't want to have crashes at intersections, at the crossings, because this is a semi.
Point well taken.
You know, I mean, I tell people there's no such thing as being clipped by a train. You know, it's going to be bad. The other picture that I'm showing, and the thing about it is the locomotive itself weighs about 200 tons or 400,000 pounds. And a train of this size is probably anywhere between 12 and 20 million pounds coming at you. Which is why when people talk to me about let's put a pedestrian path on a rail bridge or let's put one right next to it, I'm like, no, you want to keep people away from the trains. You don't want to encourage them to be cozying up next to them. Because people get complacent. They get used to seeing it, or they're busy, they're listening to headphones, or they're talking on their cell phone or whatever, and they're not paying attention to what's going on around them. And so I do worry about people and their safety at crossings. The other picture that I have is where just last summer, two men were killed by Canby. And it's not to grandiose, I'm trying to tell you, it's really, really serious when these crashes happen. And these gentlemen died in this crash. So I try very hard to help people understand that there's a reason for why you all put on the books regulation of crossings and why you want it uniform and consistent, why you want us to be careful with folks out there, because we're trying to keep them going home to their families at night. And I know when I talk to engineers that are on the trains that have had these crashes, it's traumatic for them because they can't swerve. They can't stop that train. And they've told me how, I remember one gentleman, I'll never forget him, told me, he said, I could see down the car on the track, and I could see the mom and the daughter looking at me as we hit them, and there was nothing I could do. So I don't take this lightly, and I know that you'll hear from folks from time to time who will be upset about a crossing issue. I want to work through them, but I want to do it in the public interest. I just don't think you can put a price on lives. Now, for rail safety, that section, they're the ones that, for the most part, are certified by FRA to do inspections on behalf of FRA regulations. Track inspections, the locomotives, the rail cars, and all their components like the brakes, etc. Operating practices, when I say operating practices, I mean things like looking at the log books, the operating hours, because they have hours of service issues just like truck drivers do. Alcohol and drug testing, hazardous material, all those things are federally regulated, signals. My inspectors are certified by the feds, and they can only be certified in one discipline. You can't be both a track inspector and an equipment inspector because it's so complicated. They want you to just be a specialist in the one discipline. Now, I also have a couple of folks that that enforce state laws. These are the walkway and clearance inspectors to make sure that the rail employees are safe and have enough room around them when they're at industries loading equipment or when they're on the trains. And this section also regulates the rail transit operations, but not everything about it. Federal Transit Administration has each state required to oversee rail transit's safety plan. FTA, Federal Transit, FTA, designates what should be in that safety plan, what the components are, and it's up to each state to make sure that their rail transit operations have a safety plan that complies. We were audited for the first time, I think it was 2 years ago. We came out very well. It was our first audit, and the program had been up for several years. There had been a couple of different reiterations of federal regulations that we had incorporated into rules. We came out very well. We had a few things to fix, but nothing major. And I think we're due this year or next year for another audit. So, but the agencies we work with the most are obviously TriMet, because they're a large rail transit. And when I say rail transit, it means it's transit, but it's on rails, on fixed rail. So it's the Portland streetcar, it's the light rail, et cetera. We make sure they have a safety plan and that it complies with the FTA. And this particular department also has a key measure, a key performance measure. It's the number of train derailments caused by human track or track equipment or human error. And again, derailments are going down. It's not where I want it to be. We've had, you know, when we have a turnover in staff, we lose some ground in this area because it takes about a year or more for a person to be trained and certified to be able to do the inspections by themselves. So we lose some productivity when we've got turnover of staff just because it is so complicated. But it is down and it's going down. Planning projects and operations. This is where we do passenger and freight rail planning. Projects like Connect Oregon, we have the oversight as we've granted money to different rail different rail projects. We are overseeing those projects. I've got folks who are going out. My inspectors, when they go out and visit the sites to see if they're up with the milestones where they're supposed to be with the particular project at a particular time. And then we're reviewing their invoices and making sure they're getting paid. And when the project's complete, we close out the books on it. So we do watch the Connect Oregon 1 and 2 rail projects. This is the area that manages the state right-of-way that we own. We own about 170 miles of rail right-of-way. That's the ground beneath the tracks. There's two things to own in a railroad: the ground beneath the tracks, the right-of-way, and the right to be on that track operating as a railroad. We don't own that part. But we own the part of the ground. And that's because Burlington Northern was thinking about abandoning the Astoria line between Portland and Astoria and part of the Oregon Electric line between Portland and Salem. And they didn't have a buyer for it. And so rather than have it gone and just ripped up and not around anymore for a rail corridor, they asked the state, if we donate it to you, would you be willing to take it on? And we said yes, and because we really want to keep rail corridors intact. Nobody is out there plowing up ground building rail corridors anymore. Very, very, very rare. So we need to protect them. They're a little bit of an endangered species themselves. So we have that. And yes. This is, yes.
Question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what is our responsibility with the right-of-ways that we own? What does the state of Oregon do with that right-of-way? If we don't own the tracks itself, what are we doing there what's our responsibility? Sorry if this is obvious, but I don't get it.
That's fine, Madam Chair and Representative. What we do is, because these particular lines have an active railroad on them, the maintenance then is to the railroad. So all we're doing is making sure that the land is there. I mean, we own the land. And while there's an active railroad, they maintain the track, the vegetation, the bridges, et cetera. Should they decide to discontinue service and walk away, we will still own it and be able to, they'll probably sell it to another operator. But it just makes sure that the corridor's not gone.
Thank you.
You bet. This is also the section that manages the state-supported Amtrak Cascade trains. And That service started back in 99, and the passenger ridership has continued to increase. We added a second train I think it was like 2001 or so, but it continues to increase. And in fact, in last year, we were setting record numbers. It was up 26% 08 over 07. Now, some of that, I think, was due to the fuel prices and change. We could actually see the riderships change and grow as gas got to $4 a gallon. But this is the route that runs between Eugene and Portland on up to Seattle and Vancouver, B.C. Again, we have a key performance measure. It's tracking the number of riders, and it continues to grow, and I think it will continue to grow. The rail study. Now, I think some of you have heard about this. This was something that was directed by the 2007 Oregon legislature. I was allocated $2 million to do an assessment of the system. When we had things like lines being shut down because of tunnel issues and all sorts of, rail has come into the focus, and people are wondering about it. And it's privately owned for the most part. There's only, out of the 22 railroads in the state, only like two or three are publicly owned. Everything else is privately owned. And when I say privately owned, other than that right-of-way that I owned, it means they own the ground, the track, and the right to be there, and nobody else can be there unless they say so. It's not like our roads. So we don't have a lot of information because it's not our infrastructure per se. So they wanted me to do an assessment of the system, its uses, its business trends, where it's going, how we can mitigate it, if something's going to harm us. If we could look forward and say, oh, this business trend is going to have this domino effect, and we're going to have some shippers that are going to have problems getting service, or this outlying area is not going to have a rail line, what could we do about it? It's to give you information to make a strategic blueprint about investments. And so if you are investing like you have with Connect 1 and Connect 2, Connect Oregon 1 and Connect Oregon 2, then you would have some information ahead of you about the corridors, how they're used, which ones are main corridors, which ones aren't. Not that you may not want to make something an investment on a small one, but you at least have better information than you've had in the past. And also looking at passenger rail, so we've initiated it. We initiated the study last February. We're just about done with the first segment. The first segment had looking at mostly short lines, their bridges, their tunnels, because that's really a big question mark. We just didn't have a good inventory, and yet we know that there's some issues with them. I'm going to touch on them in a minute. So we've done mostly on the short lines. We've done their bridges and tunnels. We've looked at some passenger rail options. I've had people ask me, do we have to be on the Union Pacific line that's really, really busy? It's kind of like the I-5 of rail traffic, just like, the I-5 road. Could we be on another line? I've looked at what it would take to move over to the Oregon Electric line. That's the other line that runs parallel in the valley. It would obviously need some upgrades, et cetera, but it's, it is doable. We'd have to work it out with the railroad. Again, you can't be there unless the railroad wants you to be there. So that first segment's almost done. We're going to start the second segment any time now. We're working on the contract with that. We're working with Parsons Brinkerhoff, and they have quite an extensive team that's helping us with these different components. We're looking at commuter rail. We're looking at what it would take, high-level feasibility, to take what is just launched between Wilsonville and Beaverton and extend it down to Salem. And there's some issues, because you've not just one railroad, but two railroads to deal with in that stretch of track. So we're working on it. I believe it'll be done by the end of the summer, and then it'll be put in a report, and I'll obviously probably be coming back to an interim committee somewhere and giving you an update on it.
Another question for
yes.
you, Representative Goff.
Thank you. thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly with regards to the West commuter rail, are we looking at also... one of the things that I was very surprised about with the West commuter rail was actually just how much it costs to rehabilitate the line, all that went involved with that, and then even on top of that, the fact that now that the trains are moving faster, their insurance is higher, and that we're picking up the TriMet is picking up a part of that tab too. So I mean, there's a lot of costs that are coming along with the West commuter rail to the public dollar. Are we looking at what that cost looks like, say, as opposed to maybe what it looks like to build our own public lines, if there's even capacity for that at this point with regards to some of this, maybe extending west, maybe connecting Portland and Salem, all of these things. Are we looking at the broad spectrum of options here? Because I'm just wondering what the costs look like on all fronts. Does that make sense?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Call, I would tell you that I'm not looking specifically at that, but I can tell you I know something about it because we've not with this study, but we've talked about it. You will still have probably all of the same costs for building the infrastructure because steel is steel, no matter who's building it or for what reason. And you'll have bridges to build instead of bridges to upgrade, et cetera. And on top of that, you're going to have right-of-way to acquire. And that's usually when, I know when TriMet does light rail, it is right-of-way acquisition that costs a lot of it. Now, not that the electrification isn't expensive and all of that system, but so I don't think it would be less expensive to build. In fact, I think it'd be more expensive to build. And as for the insurance rates, well, you have to understand the freight system, they are reluctant to have passenger rail on their system for a couple of reasons. One, it takes up their capacity, and two, the whole liability. When you have an accident, God forbid, and somebody's hurt, it's, you know, you don't get sued by freight, but you do get sued by people. So, I mean, they have that legitimate concern, and it's on their system, so they want the protection. I think that even if the state were to buy right-of-way, et cetera, we'd have to have some sort of liability protection, too. And the operations are going to be the same. I mean, you might be able to cut the cost down here and there a little bit. I don't think it's going to be dramatically different.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So just to cover some – any other questions before I go on? Okay. Just to cover a few rail statistics, and then I'll go so that you can listen to some of the other folks. I mentioned that we have 22 railroads in Oregon. We do. We have two Class 1s. Now, when I say Class 1, Class 2, Class 3, I've got the designation there in your testimony. It's basically based on revenue and miles of track. And the more money you make and the revenue and the miles of track, then you're a Class 1, and the middle column is Class 2, and the smaller ones are Class 3. In Oregon, we pretty much have Class 3s and maybe one Class 2. And then the two Class 1s. We've got Union Pacific and Burlington Northern. In fact, west of the Mississippi, there's only two Class 1s, Burlington Northern, BNSF, and Union Pacific. Nearly half of the lumber, wood, and paper products shipped out of Oregon are by rail. Ag is another big user of rail. 60% of the Oregon shippers are located on short line and regional railroads. So, again, it isn't just the I-5. There's a lot of outlying communities that are relying on rail to get their product to market either in Oregon or across the country or even globally. A rail car's capacity is equal to 3 to 4 trucks, so it's a good thing to have rail versus you don't have enough road space and capacity, put it on rail. The railroads handle about 196,000 rail car loads a year, so you can imagine that's like almost 600,000 trucks. And now let's just talk, I'm going to switch from just the general, I'm going to go on to short line issues. Basically, between the two, short lines were created after the Staggers Act in 1980. The Class 1 spun off low density or low profit lines. They didn't have much business or, you know, whatever, but they decided it wasn't profitable to keep them or they were merging and they needed to justify, you know, mergers, et cetera. So they spun them off. And folks took them over. In an entrepreneurial spirit, they took them over as short lines. And we have 20 short lines and two Class 1s. So, and of the roughly 2,400 miles in Oregon of rail, over 54% of it is owned by short lines and operated by short lines. So we have more short line miles than we do Class 1 miles in Oregon. Now, so the short lines, their issues are they have typically track that they might have inherited or purchased in poor condition or deferred maintenance, and they don't have a lot of business to generate the revenue to keep it up. So the short lines tend to have maintenance infrastructure issues, whereas the Class 1s have enough money to keep their infrastructure in place should they have a bridge go out. Well, perfect example is Union Pacific late last winter, the winter before, when they had the huge slide by Oak Ridge that took them out of business for 3 or 4 months. They fixed it themselves, and I think it was just, you know, I'm going to say somewhere between $70 and $100 million. It was a lot of money to put that back, and they did it themselves. A short line has a bridge go out. They may be out of business. You know, well, we had three tunnels, and they pulled the line. So that's the big difference. Short lines have need for bridges and tunnels and upgrading their track to handle the industry standard weight of car. They call them 286. It's 286,000 pounds, and the jargon term is 286. So now you can throw around a rail term, 286 car. It takes about $250,000 to $300,000 to upgrade a mile of track. That's a rough estimate to bring it up to handle the 286 car. Now, they'll handle them, but they'll go very, very slow. And they may have a derailment, they may have the rail brake. So they try to handle them, but they're not really built for it. It's not really efficient what they try to do, but they'll do it. So bringing their track up to speed, bridges and tunnels are aging, just like on the highway side of the house. The rail side of the house has got aging issues. The rail bridges were built mostly in the 40s and 50s. They're starting to reach their peak. And frankly, the tunnels. There are 69 tunnels in the state of Oregon and 34 on the short line, and most of them are over 100, could be over 100 years old. They were built between 1883 and 1916 for the majority of them. And they were built with timber ribs. And, of course, what does timber do eventually? Rot. Especially on the pieces that hit the ground that are holding it up with the water in the tunnels. And Oregon's known for its moisture. So they have aging infrastructure issues. Class 1s, they can take care of their infrastructure pretty much, but they have trouble building capacity for more volume of business. And that's where we see that. Now, rail funding. I know you heard from the railroads. Rail is one of the most capital-intensive industries there are. It takes 18 to 20% of their revenue to put back in their capital to keep them going. And that's why when the legislature recognized the importance of rail to the economy of Oregon, et cetera, and being such an important part of the system, you all have recognized that, and you've come forth with funding a couple of different ways. And I thank you for that, because it's made a big difference. In both the 2001 and 2003 session, you granted $2 million each session towards short lines only. And that was huge for them to make some of those infrastructure improvements to keep themselves going. In 2005, you granted $8 million towards an industrial rail spurs. That's sort of a driveway off to serve a particular industry or businesses out there. And then, of course, the granddaddy of all, Connect Oregon 1 and 2, $100 million both times. And I want you to know that of the 05 funds, nearly $40 million went to rail projects. And in 07, $56.6 million went to rail projects. They really had a lot of good projects out there. Some of the other modes didn't have as many applications in, didn't have as much that they applied for. But rail had, well, we always have, as you know, more need than there ever is money to go around. And that was true both in Connect 1 and Connect 2. So I thank you for that, because those projects are huge for both jobs, keeping the goods going, moving, and keeping those communities hooked up to the rest of the state and the rest of the world. Because not everybody, not everybody wants to live along the I-5 corridor or in the valley, nor should they have to. We should be able to have infrastructure around the state that would allow people to live in other areas and prosper. I will close just by saying that, again, the transportation is critical to supporting a healthy economy. You guys know that. Railroads are an important part of the system. And I think that what our programs and mandates do is help the state's livability by developing a safe and efficient railroad system that sustains job, minimizes environmental impact, and contributes to effective land use. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to give you this briefing.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I understand that the good people in Coos Bay have found the money to buy that rail line that goes into Coos Bay. When will that be up and running? Do you have any idea on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes. Oregon Economic Development is in the process of loaning them the remaining money that they needed to purchase the line. I don't know that they have. I did listen in on the commission's meeting to grant that loan, and they asked the port director that, Jeff Bishop, and I believe his answer was that they were going to get it up as quickly as they could, but they will need to have some funds that they're going to be applying for, looking at federal loans, et cetera, and other possibly stimulus money, to do some repairs, because they still have to repair the tunnels and everything. I think it'll probably be... It could be up to a year. It could be less. I don't know. It'll depend on the money that they get in.
Follow-up?
And then we had that issue, and I'm glad to hear that, and I look forward to that, because I think there's a lot of potential there, and I hope it comes to be. And obviously, we saw the Tillamook Railroad that probably isn't coming back. Do you see any other short lines like that where we can anticipate some and get ahead of some issues like this rather than waiting for some, catastrophe or some business pulling out? proactively act on it rather than waiting for something to hit us?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffert, that is a really good question, and the answer is yes in some ways and no in others. I think that the study that I'm doing is going to help us because it's going to let us know better what the infrastructure condition is, which tunnels are not so good, which bridges may not be so good, that may not have a 20-year lifespan left in them, and how they're being used, and as far as commodity flow and where the corridors are, so we know where we're vulnerable. I'm also tracking, every year I get reports from all the railroads as to their revenue and carloads, so I'm tracking each year how it's going up or down, and I believe they're due into me by May 1st of this year. I believe that this recession is harming, it is like other businesses, it's hurting the rail business, and I think there may be some short lines that are on shaky ground. I'll know better in May when I get the reports, but I know that I got a call from Well, Representative Spence, with the Colorado, Wyoming, who is hurting because the rail cars are down and they don't have much infrastructure or much revenue to do for their infrastructure. Now, they haven't said they're going to abandon yet, but I know that they're concerned, and I know that the companies that they serve are concerned. I am doing my best to keep my ear to the ground. The revenue reports that I get in May will help me see how things are going.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have a quick question, just, and I assume you are following the stimulus, federal stimulus package. So, what might be in there, and how can it be used?
Well, Madam Chair, I will tell you, I'm not as familiar with it as some of the others in the department, but I am doing my best to keep up with it. I know that there is certainly money in there for passenger-related issues. And frankly, I don't think that there's a piece that is multimodal. It's not as big as the passenger piece or the highway, but in there it can be used for rail transit, et cetera, and it could be freight rail. I think that some of the passenger rail component is very, very large. And I think there are some issues, there are some projects we could do in the Portland area that would be passenger related but also help the freight system. In the Portland Triangle area, we did a study back in 2003 that identified several projects that would help the bottleneck and stuff. And there are some of those that would benefit passenger and freight, so you could do them probably with passenger that would help freight. There are some along the Union Pacific line that would be freight capacity that could be passenger-related that would help freight capacity. We're still waiting to get all the details. We just got a copy of the bill, I understand, late yesterday, and they're busy pouring over to see. But I have talked to railroads. I've had railroads ask me, you know, what should we do? And I said, you should send me a list of projects that you think are shovel-ready that could go very, very quickly and the jobs, et cetera, that are associated with them. So as we digest what's in the stimulus and look forward, I would have at least something to go by should we need to vet projects quickly. So they've been doing that. They've had some railroads doing that. And we also know from the Connect Oregon what some of the needs were. So it just depends on exactly what it ends up being and how fast they could move on those projects.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so thank you for coming.
Thank you very
today.
Much for the opportunity. I very much appreciate it.
And if you're hanging around in case
I am.
Conversation stimulates questions.
Yes. I'm still here. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call Brock Nelson and Terry Finn, if you don't mind coming up together. Brock is with Union Pacific, and Terry Finn is with BNSF. Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Brock Nelson. I'm Director of Public Affairs for the states of Oregon and Washington, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. What I thought I'd do is just start out with a quick overview of Union Pacific Railroad, talk a little bit about the benefits of rail transportation, and then I'll kind of close with our presence in Oregon and some of the opportunities and issues that face us here. This is Union Pacific Railroad. We operate in 23 states. We have about 50,000 employees and 32,000 miles of track. Our key interchange points are in Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, and New Orleans. We have a fleet of about 8,500 locomotives, approximately 250,000 rail cars that we own, and we operate through about 7,000 communities across our system. Now, as you can see, in Oregon, we have about 1,600 employees, about 1,000 miles of track, and we're committed to providing a quality rail service. We've been here a long time and plan to be here a long time into the future. Just a little bit about Union Pacific's values and priorities. Safety is our top priority, the safety of our employees, our customers, and the communities we operate through is extremely important, and we value that and emphasize everything we do around that value. Customer value, productivity, we're always looking for ways to improve the value to our shippers, looking for ways to provide an efficient product. This time, we're currently at a point where our customer satisfaction and our velocity is higher than it's ever been. Velocity is a key measure that a railroad like ours uses to kind of measure the fluidity of freight movement across the system. So from a railroad perspective, we're doing extremely well these days. As Kelly Taylor had mentioned, railroads are extremely capital intensive. Even with the economic challenges that we're faced with these days, we're committed to maintaining our railroad. This year's capital budget is approximately $2.8 billion, which we will invest to keep the railroad running smoothly and efficiently. One of the things we've been focusing on of late is improving our relationships and visibility in the communities that we operate through. A few years ago, we added some positions, not unlike the one I'm in right now, in an effort to put a face on the railroad and be more responsive to issues raised by the public and the communities that we operate through. That being said, just wanted to take a minute to talk a little bit about our charitable arm. The UP Foundation, which is an annual grant program, we've in the last year, 2008, contributed $220,000 within the state of Oregon through the UP Foundation and through another program. It's our flagship charitable program called the Principals Partnership. This is a program where we support high school principals with technical support and peer support. We've got 36 high schools participating in the state of Oregon. Across our system, there's 1,000 high schools that participate, and we've got an actual waiting list for people to get involved in that. A little bit about the benefits of rail transportation. Obviously, a steel wheel on steel rail is extremely efficient. One train can take approximately 280 trucks off the road. Union Pacific can haul one ton of freight 790 miles on a gallon of fuel. Rail transportation is more fuel efficient and less polluting than other modes. This we'll start to kind of focus on Oregon a little bit more here. This is our capital spending program between 2003 and 2007. We've invested $265 million in the state of Oregon. You can see the big chunk of that is maintenance away. What maintenance away represents is that's the rail, the ties, the surfacing, the maintaining the railroad on a day-to-day basis. Capacity, we've spent $29 million on that. A lot of what we spent our money on during this time frame was raising tunnel clearances down on the I-5 corridor, which, of course, benefits the movement of freight through that area and will help take trucks off the highway. A little bit more about our commitment to Oregon. Again, I just mentioned the tunnel clearances. Unfortunately, that picture's says Doris, California. I only included it to show how we go about improving tunnel clearances, and it's not like you'd think. Rather than actually raising the tunnel, we lower the track. It's a lot easier and a lot less expensive. Fraser, Oregon. You heard Kelly Taylor refer to that, and I've got a little bit more information on that here in a couple minutes. But again, a huge cost to us, but it was the right thing to do. We were out of service for about 105 days, and during that time period, the good news was we had some ways to move freight around this, and typically only had our shippers experience maybe 46 to 72 hours delay from their normal delivery of freight. Connect Oregon, we feel that is an outstanding example of public-private partnerships. These are some projects that we're participating in. We had a siding out in Hinkle that we were able to construct. We're involved in the Ramsey Yard and South Rivergate projects in the Port of Portland. And then we've got under Connect Oregon 2, the St. John's lead bypass that we're working on right now. And we're very much looking forward to Connect Oregon 3. All right, this is in an effort here to kind of show the order of magnitude of the Fraser slide. These are pictures of that area a week prior to the slide, and it's almost, it is a year to the date that we experienced this. It happened in January of 2008, and again, we were out of service for 105 days. But this gives you a feel for what that area looked like. This is, even though it's an aerial photograph, this is what it looked like after the slide. Because of the mountainous terrain, we have to basically ascend the grade through a series of switchbacks and cutbacks, and the actual slide knocked us out in two different locations. This is kind of some ground level pictures of what it looked like and what our crews experienced when they showed up that day. The first manager on site was a little bit more optimistic than ultimately it came to be. Railroaders really can get things done when we're faced with a natural disaster of this area. But I think the initial report was we'd be out for a couple of days, and of course 105 days later we opened the track. But I wanted to kind of give you some what we call the Fraser mudslide by the numbers. 200, that was the number of workers on site during peak activity. 150, that was the number of pieces of equipment on site. 666,000 board feet of timber salvaged, which we feel is enough to build about 66 three-bedroom homes. 700,000 tons of rock was hauled in to restabilize the mountain. 1 million tons of mud and unsuitable material was removed. And zero was the number of hotel rooms in the city of Oak Ridge while we were doing all this. And in closing, I'd like to say that the good news for Oak Ridge is that was UP's version of the stimulus packages we're talking about these days. So with that, I'd answer any questions as best I can.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boone,
where did they stay then?
Yeah.
we filled up the hotel rooms.
Oh, you were saying available rooms. Got it.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Bip camp.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Schaffler.
I'm just glad we're salvaging some timber somewhere.
Thank you. 52 minutes today.
No aggregate yet, though.
Yeah, no aggregate. Thank you, and you want to go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Terry Finn, representing Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway, and as I've listened to Kelly Taylor and now Brock Nelson, I'm afraid my presentation has shrunk down and down and down as I go on. But one thing I thought I'd dwell on a little bit is kind of the state of railroading under the current economic conditions in Oregon. BNSF is the number two class one in the state of Oregon. We have about 435 miles of track or track sharing that we do here, approximately 330 or 350 employees, and I think the payroll is around $25 or $27 million in the state of Oregon. Oregon is a very important place for BNSF, however, largely because of the port at Portland, Port of Portland, the ag-producing areas of Oregon, and things like autos and building supplies and things like that we haul in and out of the state. There is no doubt that our current economic condition has infected the railroad business, finally. I think we railroads were doing pretty well through most of 2008, but I think the last couple of months of last year saw the beginning of the decline, and then the decline became almost a free fall for a little while. However, that doesn't mean that railroads are as bad off as some industries. While we're down, we still have a fairly healthy volume in some of our areas. Perhaps the biggest downturn for us at BNSF has been in the auto business in Portland area, where we used to send out about 5 trains a week, auto trains full of autos, to other points of the U.S. We're only sending about 2 now. So that tells you something, and I think the last we look in the month of February, there were only for the Honda facility in Portland, there were only 2 ships scheduled to stop for the whole month of February. And that's going to be about 4 days worth of heavy loading. Take our railroad about 4 days to haul that off. So that tells you something about the decline in that business. Our Ford facility, where we own the land, but they lease from us, which also handles, I think, Nissan and I forget, Acura maybe. And those are come from plants in the U.S., but come to Portland, to Western Oregon for distribution in this state and other places on the West Coast. That's also down severely, I would say. So I think that's our biggest body blow, if you will, has been in the auto business right now. About the same number of trains are actually moving in and out of the state of Oregon for BNSF. They're just shorter. Instead of a 7,000-foot train, now we're running trains that are 5,500 to 6,000 feet long. We receive about at least 2 trains. In normal times, we receive 2 trains a day from the Chicago area. When I say Chicago, Chicago is the largest rail hub in the United States, and it's a huge center for trucking and for other railroads. They hand off their cargoes to the UP or to BNSF, and we distribute throughout the western United States. So in normal times, we receive about 2 trains a day into western Oregon from other parts of the country. They're now shorter, and we usually send out about 10 trains a week from the Portland area. And again, they're just shorter trains. We're still running about 10 trains out. They're just not carrying as much volume. Grain is one of the bright lights still. I think last year was a tremendously large record year for grain hauling for our railroad, and I think probably for UP too. It will be down in 2009, we know, but the level of grain volume that we haul to the Portland area and to elevators on the Columbia River will be more like a typical year. Last year was just very extraordinary. We're not looking for any big depressed kind of volume in the grain market. Intermodal, which is containerized cargo, Portland remains a very big hub for domestic intermodal cargo. Cargo shipped in containers from other points of the United States and brought here for distribution, and some going the other way as well. There's not as much international traffic here, but there are a lot of volume in intermodal domestic cargo. Aside from the auto transport business, our most hard hit business center would be industrial products, and that's all related to home building. That's concrete, aggregate, lumber, furniture, appliances. All that has sunk largely because of the downturn in the housing industry. Our tank car business is down only a little, and our tank car business is mostly the additives for gasoline and other refined lubricating products, not the fuel itself, but the additives. We still run maybe 30 to 40 tank cars in and out of the Portland area every week. Our mission in this economy is to really cut our costs and keep costs low while we still provide service to our customers. I know it's a touchy subject to talk about any layoffs or furloughs. So far, we've actually only had to lay off about 5 people in the Vancouver-Portland area, and the railroad's struggling very hard to try to keep people on board as best we can. And in some cases, that means going to kind of the, not the labor board, but the, I forget the term that's often used, where you're calling workers up and, you know, day by day. But it's a way of trying to keep good employees' benefits active so that they're not completely cut off. And we don't want to lose the experience that we have either in this down economy. I just want to fill in a little bit that Kelly Taylor said about crossings. I really commend the state of Oregon for its program and the work that the rail division does, because it sounds awful to say, but crossings are the bane of any railroad. You know, if a railroad had its druthers, it wouldn't have any crossings. But since we know they're needed, and we know that we have to be safe, and we know that you can't stop a train, a 50-mile-an-hour freight train might take a mile and a half to actually stop. So it's usually not the train's fault when a collision occurs. It's someone pulling onto the tracks. And we very much are involved in crossing safety. I would say safety of our employees and of the public is the number one rail concern, both for humanitarian reasons and for, frankly, liability reasons. We really like to see that those crossing device regulations and how roads are closed or how crossings are maintained or allowed to be in the hands of a single agency, so we can have consistency and reliability and know how that will be treated in the state of Oregon. So we think the rail division does a great job of that. Thank you for Connect 1, Connect 2. They've been great. We have a couple of projects in those, and it was great working with the Rail Advisory Committee and the division. We think we have really good projects that have a public benefit as well as a private benefit, and we're happy to be partners in that. And again, in passenger rail, BNSF is cooperating with the state of Oregon in its long-term look at how to extend passenger rail, mostly south of Portland and Salem, I think. And we're involved in that look, and we have adopted a policy as a company that we will take careful look at passenger rail service. We run about 10 Amtrak trains a day are running now from Seattle to Portland. We also have commuter rail running on our Washington lines as well. It's a difficult mix between passenger rail running on freight tracks, because sometimes a passenger train is only as fast as the slowest freight. So you have to have lots of workarounds and crossovers and sidings and everything else to make it flexible. But so far, I think it's been productive, and it's been safe, and it's been a boon to both the public and the railroads. I'll stop there and entertain questions.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's extremely interesting. I've been hearing a lot about gargantuan container ships out of China that when the canal is expanded will be making their way from overseas to New York far more inexpensively than trains can make it from here to New York. And I'm just curious what the railroad's long-term plans are for increasing the speed and efficiency of your systems. And I'm not sure whether that's the correct comparison to be drawn, but I just throw it out.
Actually, that's a great question. In a former life, I was in the port business. So these large ships, which now are on drawing boards that can go as 10,000 TEUs, and a TEU is a 20-foot equivalent unit, which is it's the original container size, and most containers are now 40-foot. Containers, 20-foot containers with the originals. 10,000, that's a huge ship. It's too big for the Panama Canal. It's actually, many of them are now too big for the Suez Canal. And we call them Cape-size vessels because they either have to go around Cape Horn or Cape of Good Hope. And whether or not they can make the all-water route, and a widened Panama Canal will be able to accommodate these ships, most of them. But it's still a big question mark. And the railroad has looked at these very closely, and I assume that Union Pacific has looked at this too. If you're in the ocean freight business, you're looking at rates that have been as low as they've ever been. They are running ships today just to pay for the crew and the fuel rather than see them rust tied up someplace. It's horrible to be in that business right now. The question is, if you have an all-water route, say from Hong Kong or China to New York or China to Norfolk, Virginia or something, are you going to make the investment in the additional ships that you will need to make that 25-day journey in some ways rather for the all-water route rather than the 10 to 12 days that it takes now to get to various points on the West Coast? And yes, the answer is we are looking at how to speed up our system. We just BNSF just announced a new train system that goes from the ports of Seattle and Tacoma now that chops a whole day off the trip to Chicago and to Memphis, Tennessee. We have to keep finding ways for our system to accommodate these faster express sort of trains because the name of the game is getting cargo there on time. The transportation system is the new warehouse, is the new pipeline. Nothing sits in a warehouse anymore. It sits in a transportation system on its way and then for scheduled delivery.
Thank you.
I do have you written down. I'm just going to forget you for a while.
It's not about timber, Matt. It's not about timber.
Representative Schaffler.
But I'll think of something here. It is about agriculture, but I love the train. I love riding on them. The railroad is a 19th century stimulus package, if ever there was one, and it's still stimulating the economy, and I wish you well in your efforts to make it better and maintain it. But I had some wheat farmers in my office this morning, and this comes up every session here about cars and the availability of cars and the train stopping. And I don't mean to put you guys on the spot. I just wanted to know if you wanted to shed any light on that issue.
I think Brock does.
Okay. You referred to grain, and you're right. Grain is huge. As a matter of fact, my brother runs Cargill Louis Dreyfus Grain in Portland. And he moved here in 1980, and he's raised his family, and it helps. It's a great economic driver here in the Northwest. You actually triggered the question in my mind. So.
Well, what I would say, I guess, in response to that, is that it begs for a happy relationship or medium between, you know, short haul trucks, short line railroads, and Class One railroads. You know, the Class Ones, you know. Typically what you hear is that, you know, back in the day we could, you know, get a car a week and the railroads were happy to take it and haul it, and things have kind of changed. And over time, you know, as the business in some of these areas has not been there to support the investment in the infrastructure, you know, we've spun off or made these more available to the short lines who don't have to operate with our, you know, the agreements and overheads and things that we do and can maybe do things a little bit more efficiently and make it work. So I guess all I would say is, without knowing the specifics, you know, some folks look back to the way it used to be and things have changed, but, you know, we got to look at the best way to kind of get all these modes together to get the wheat to market.
And I'll just add that we have looked at that, and that's been a car availability comes up annually. And I think it's, in general, I know in both, I think, Oregon and the state of Washington, we've actually improved our car availability. And cars are there when they're supposed to be. Not always. It's still a problem because, as Brock mentioned, velocity. And, you know, it used to be, when I first came to the railroad, which hasn't been very long ago, the old reports I saw, we were maybe handling a hopper car, was turning over, in other words, being used in a cycle maybe 1.3 times in a month. And in our major wheat growing areas, we're turning those cars over about 3 times a month now. That's how much the velocity, and that's the way you save costs, using that equipment faster, turning it over faster, and getting, you know, being able to take some of your equipment off your track to increase capacity and stuff like that. But I, you know, I would say we're doing a better job. We have a program in place that's more responsive than it has been in the last couple of years. So I think we're doing better. I don't know if your complaints are getting any less or any fewer.
Just for the record, Madam Chair. My brother wasn't complaining. It was weed farmers.
I understand.
He's watching. But and I do want to thank you, too, for keeping those workers on as long as you can. I think that's a good way to run a business. Then you're right. They are skilled people. And I got a friend, Dennis Peterson. He signed on with the Chicago. It was then Chicago Northwestern. I don't know what it is now, but he's been there over 30 years now. And it's been a darn good living for him, so I'm glad you're keeping those folks on.
There are just many railroad workers who are third, fourth, even more generations than that, whose whole families have been there forever. And I'm working with several of them right now, so.
Thank you.
As info, I'm a former CNNW.
Oh, is that right?
19 years, so yeah. Now we're owned by Union Pacific, so.
Just a couple of words in defense of you. For years, we heard about these lumber rail car shortages, and you were always trying to fill that gap. Well, now, if you go to Prineville, on every sidetrack, there's a bunch of lumber cars because there's no demand for it. So it's a difficult
balance
that you have to maintain to decide which cars you build and how many.
One more thing to add, and I don't want to whitewash the economic plight and say that the railroads, everything's hunky-dory, because it's certainly not. But I'll just bring this up. We now, and the situation has to be somewhat similar for the Union Pacific. I heard the other day that we, BNSF, has more than 500 miles of rail cars parked right now. Now, try to figure out how many rail cars that is. That's a lot. In fact, they're parked all over the place, and people are complaining about them being in their views. So that's the next thing we're facing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we are experiencing exactly the same issue. I haven't equated ours to the length of track yet, but we have well in excess of 1,000 locomotives in storage. We have somewhere around 48,000 rail cars in storage. And just hoping that the economy turns around and planning to be in a position to respond quickly when it does.
Mr. Finn, I just have a quick question, and it comes off of Representative Benz's question. You were talking about shaving a day off of the trip from Seattle to Chicago, and I was kind of curious what it took to do that. I assume it was investment and...
Well, some of it's actual speed increases in certain areas, and you know the railroad maintenance is constantly looking for ways to improve track, straighten curves. If the track's uneven, you know, trying to even track so the trains can run at a higher rate of speed, but it's also how it's handled when it reaches a yard or a point on its destination, how fast it's expedited through. You know, what can be a complex rail system, and that's a lot of it. And then what kind of special permission do dispatchers give this train to move, and does it clear everything else out of the way as this train proceeds across the country? And a lot of it is train control. It's true, railroading is still very much a 19th century technology of steel wheel on steel rails, but the management of the track, how the trains are run across the country, is very 21st century high tech. And it's a great experience, and I know UP has one to go into the Network Operations Center, and ours is in Fort Worth, Texas. It looks like the movie War Games, with concentric screens on the giant wall and darkened computer stations all over. And you can see virtually every train running on our system all the time, and there are hundreds at a time. So with those kinds of improvements, you can actually speed how trains move.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you on that. I love riding the train, and I've ridden it all over Western America and some other places. But I know going through North Dakota, it's slow, really slow down, which I didn't care. I was in the lounge car drinking beer. I didn't care how fast we went, counting antelope.
But I can't wait to do it again. But how do you? I know Amtrak uses your tracks, and where do you see passenger train going in this country? I hope it's not going away. But do you want to just? Can you touch on that, or do you feel comfortable touching on that?
Well, just something that might be a surprise to you. I mean, given that we characterize ourselves as a freight railroad, but Union Pacific has about 1 million passengers a week on our system between Chicago, the Bay Area, Southern California, and then what goes on with the existing Amtrak routes that operate over us. But it is a challenge, and not unlike what Terry had indicated, as we're being faced with those types of desires, we're trying to work with the interested parties to, evaluate it, to see if there is something that could be done. But the challenge is that you really want us to be a freight railroad, and you really want us to be successful, because there's so many good things about what we do for the environment, taking trucks off the highway. You kind of got to look at the big picture and see what it is that you're really, really trying to accomplish. But we're trying to work. We've just spent a lot of time out in Denver. They were looking to put together a commuter railroad out there, and we went through the process with them, and they thought to do something differently. But it is a very challenging and sensitive discussion to have with a freight railroad. But.
And it's expensive because you need so much track improvement and sidings and crossovers and stuff to get trains to pass each other. A bunch of freights can go at kind of the same speed and be several miles apart, but when you put a passenger train in there that needs to go faster, it really presents a very complicated track management sort of situation. I think passenger rail is here to stay, and frankly politically, as long as there's money to help subsidize passenger rail, once on, I don't not really a good way to peel it off again, but it has to be. I know from our point of view, we've been looking at, when you talk about commuter rail, for instance, or commuter runs, have to be kept in very limited windows so you don't foul all the freight traffic at other times. Mm-hmm. And with some of the capacity improvements that you get from passenger rail, you can run some freight. You can increase the capacity sometimes for freight as well, so it's a double benefit. But to run trains on freight rail, to run passenger trains all day long on freight rail, presents a very difficult issue.
Just to clarify, I didn't mean commuter in town. I meant Amtrak going through the countryside. But on the environmental side, you guys have been, the railroads in general have been advertising that fact, and that's a good. Those are great statistics, and I encourage you there. Have you seen an increase in the use of the rail system because of that knowledge being disseminated about how much freight you can carry on a gallon of fuel, or is it just something you're sharing with people, or has it had an impact as far as your business goes?
We've seen it. I think I can point to cases where customers have come to rail in part for the savings they get, the efficiency they get out of rail, but also because rail is perceived to be green. Hmm. Now, in fact, I can go right to the Port of Seattle. At their Terminal 18 on Harbor Island at the Port of Seattle, they are getting a new customer that's a French shipper that also handles Maersk, too, part of the Maersk trade. And they are demanding on-dock rail at the Port of Seattle as a condition of them going there. And they are virtually within a quarter mile of the rail yard. They could truck the containers there very easily, but they want on-dock rail because they are a green shipper.
Well, I'll get behind that green program, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate you coming today.
Thank you.
I think we're going to take just a couple minutes to get one of our next panelists on the phone. And in the meantime, I can call up David Anser with Portland and Western Rail. And Sid Ingebretson. You can correct me, from Mount Hood Railroad. And we're getting Dan Lovelady, City of Prineville Railroad, on the phone. And we're going to have to...
City of Prineville Railway, this is Tammy.
Move...
Hi, this is Patrick Brennan with the House Committee on Transportation. Is Dan Lovelady available?
Yeah, just a sec, please.
Was it Maersk to come into Seattle?
Yes.
Hi, it's Dan.
Hello, Dan. This is Patrick Brennan, committee staff for the House Transportation Committee. Thanks for joining us today. We are live with the committee in a hearing. We have also at the dais or at the witness table David Anzer from Portland Western Railroad and Sid Engebretson from the Mount Hood Railroad. And the three of you are our short line panel.
Okay.
And this is Chair Beyer, and thank you for being able to join us, at least by phone.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry I couldn't be there today, but the weather forecast made it seem like it wouldn't be a good day to travel over the pass.
So I guess we can go by the agenda, which puts us with David Anzer, if you want to go ahead and start. And we're going to try to keep it around 5 minutes so we can get through everything.
For the record, my name is David Anzer. I am the Director of Finance for Portland Western Railroad. I'm here on behalf of Billy Eason, our President. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me discuss short line railroads. Portland Western Railroad is a regional railroad that operates over 200 miles of railroad in northwest Oregon. We extend from Astoria to Eugene. We also operate the West Commuter Rail. We employ about 200 employees in the state. Oregon short lines provide the critical link between businesses and the national rail network, which was Union Pacific and BNSF. Most of these short lines serve in the rural Oregon, and we provide that vital link to those customers. We support the local businesses and help them keep them competitive in the global marketplace. We allow these businesses to thrive and create and maintain jobs for hardworking Oregonians. And we offer a more fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly mode of transportation. One of the things that I'd like to point out with Portland and Western is, as both UP and BNSF stated, safety is our number one importance. Portland Western is very proud of our fact that we've gone 3 years injury-free for our employees. Another important item is that even though we're in this difficult economic recession, we have furloughed very few employees, and we have been able to divert them to other projects and provide value-added services for our customers and communities, which are able to keep these employees on the job. I'd also like to thank Kelly Taylor and her entire team at ODOT Rail. They've been extremely helpful for short lines and the rail industry as a whole. Connect Oregon projects have been extremely important for the Portland and Western and for the short line industry. One of the interesting things with the Connect Oregon, the first program, was we were able to do a four-yard track switching yard up in Tigard, which allowed us to do pull all of our switching operations off the main track and put them into a yard. And it was able to us to allow the West trains to operate more efficiently and keep out of their way and keep them on time and move that operations smoothly and efficiently. Two of the other projects that we had with Connect Oregon was the Willamina and Seegers lines. These are two branch lines that serve mostly lumber companies. They are small businesses that we serve, and they were on the verge of abandonment when we took them over. We've operated them for nearly 15 years. We were able, through the Connect Oregon program, to upgrade the rail. The rail was 75-pound, 100-year-old rail that was falling apart. It was deteriorated. We were having several derailments. We were able to relay all the rail. Both branch lines combined was 20 miles of track. that rail. Since we've done that, the speed has increased from 10 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour, and we've had no derailments, which is a huge impact for our company. The Connect Oregon 2, we are looking at, we were approved for a project for Albany Yard. We're going to redo two of the two yards in Albany. There's the UP, what we call the UP yard, or our WP yard, which is our main key yard there, and we're going to divert all that traffic over to our Millersburg yard to get off of Queen Street. Queen Avenue. Queen Avenue is the number one block crossing in the state. We get lots of crossing blockage complaints there, and several fines from Kelly Taylor's department. We believe that we can, by moving the traffic over to this other yard, we will be able to reduce the amount of switching that we have to do on Queen Avenue. It'll also make a tremendous impact on the city, and it's a great project. We're looking forward to getting on it. We're in the final stages of getting that project rolling. The other project that we've had is our Astoria line. This line, just last year, Cascade Grain was our largest customer up there, and they built a 113 million gallon ethanol plant, and we serve that facility. We were bringing the 110-car unit trains up there, and all those cars are 286,000 pounds. The rail is a 90-pound rail. It's very small weight. We needed to replace that in order to handle these large cars. The plant has been operating for 9 months, and unfortunately, in December of this year, the plant just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They're in the middle of it right now. We are very hopeful that they are going to come back online and under reorganization and start the plant back up. It's a huge item for us. With the Astoria line project that we got under Connect Oregon, which is a $6.3 million grant, on a side note, we've already invested approximately $3 million in that line. And then we were getting ready. We started doing the rehab for the Connect Oregon program in December. We've halted that program just last week. We were in the middle of doing our rail relay. We decided that that's not appropriate for us to be continuing that project at this time for our own company funds and the state and the taxpayers' money. So we worked with Kelly Taylor and her group, and we decided to put a freeze on that project until we find out further information on what happens with Cascade Grain. So we'll wait and see. We're going to wait and see. We're not going to cancel the project at this time. We want to see what Cascade Grain does. We're extremely hopeful that they'll come back, and if they do, then we'll resume that project. With that, like I said, in conclusion, we are a small business and a short line that operates. We're looking forward to Connect Oregon 3. These projects are very crucial to us. We have some major bridge items that are coming up in the future that we need to address, and we also have some other rail infrastructure. One other quick fact before I forget is in the last 5 years, Portland Western has replaced over almost 100 miles of 75-pound or less size rail, which is incredible. That's almost 25% of our rail miles. So we look forward to Connect Oregon 3. We got plenty of shovel-ready projects where we really need these infrastructure projects, not only for us but also for the communities that we serve.
Thanks, Billy. Any questions? No? All right. Dan, I guess you're up. Do you hear?
I'm here.
All right. Tell us about Prineville.
Okay, well, good afternoon from Prineville, and thank you, Chair Beyer and the House Transportation Committee, for giving me the opportunity to be on the short line panel today. For the record, I'm Dan Lovelady, General Manager of the City of Prineville Railway. The City of Prineville Railway is an 18-mile short line railroad serving Central Oregon and is the oldest municipally owned and operated railroad in the United States. As recently as 2004, the Prineville Railroad had no customers and the city was considering abandonment and selling the railroad for scrap. Fortunately, city leaders realized the importance of having rail service into Prineville for economic development and attracting new industry that brings with it family wage jobs. In an effort to increase traffic on the railroad and to provide rail shipping opportunities for all non-rail served customers in central and eastern Oregon, in 2005, the city purchased an old mill site on 33 acres and set up a multimodal transload warehouse and distribution center, which they named the Prineville Freight Depot. The Prineville Freight Depot offers rail-to-truck, truck-to-rail, rail-to-rail, and truck-to-truck transfers, as well as storage, inventory, and just-in-time delivery. Since 2005, the customer base at the Prineville Freight Depot has grown more than 25 individual rail shippers with a diversified mix of products. These customers enjoy the cost efficiencies of rail transportation without having to own or lease rail infrastructure. As trucking costs increase and truck transportation becomes harder to find, more shippers are looking to rail for transportation, and transloading facilities are able to reach out further distances from their facilities to provide cheaper transportation packages. The City of Prineville Freight Depot, we were fortunate enough to be selected for a Connect Oregon 1 grant to do a Phase 1 enlargement and upgrade of our Prineville Freight Depot transload and distribution center, and also a Connect Oregon 2 grant to complete the final phases of our project. We're currently finishing Connect Oregon 1, and with that will be a 64,000 square foot warehouse that has unloading spots for 6 rail cars and 2 truck docks. We expect to go out for bid for our Connect Oregon 2 project in April. This project will construct a 45,000 square foot warehouse with rail tracks through the building, and it'll also have a 25-ton overhead crane, which will give us the ability to handle different products as well as the ability to do rail car repair. In addition, we're constructing a bulk transfer facility to handle products like cement, aggregate, sand, wood chips, and so on. When complete, we'll have a world-class facility that all of Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon industry can utilize to access the efficiencies of rail and the North American rail network. And that will help them to be competitive in regional, national, and global marketplaces. The need for reliable, affordable, and flexible transportation services are vital to small and especially rural industry in Oregon. Prior to the current economic meltdown, the large railroads like the BNSF and UP were nearing capacity. And in an effort to increase velocity and maximize their profitability, they revised their operating plans toward hauling larger trains for long distances, preferring not to stop along their main lines to switch out small customers. It's a guarantee that railroad capacity and congestion issues are only going to get worse once our economy recovers. Rural areas and small shippers throughout Oregon and the nation are going to have to realize this trend and make changes to meet the needs of the large railroads. Their shareholders are going to dictate that they maximize profits by increasing velocity, thereby increasing their capacity. Unfortunately, this is going to leave the small shipper without rail service unless they're willing to adapt. We believe that freight gathering centers like short line railroads or multimodal hubs who consolidate multiple carloads from numerous customers into one location that requires the large railroad to make only one stop is the answer to preserving rail service. In order for short line railroads to provide freight gathering services in Oregon, they must maintain their infrastructure. Short line railroads typically spend as much as 30% of their annual revenues maintaining and repairing track. Larger, heavier cars have caused stress on tracks and bridges. That have had deferred maintenance for years because the short line company did not generate sufficient revenues to invest capital back into their infrastructure. This is where you can help. Connect Oregon is truly a visionary, non-highway, multimodal program designed to reduce transportation costs for Oregon business and results in economic benefit for the state and creates jobs. The Connect Oregon programs have delivered everything that was expected and more. The provisions of the program that allow for a portion to be allocated in each region ensures that no part of the state gets left out. Connect Oregon has helped preserve the future of the City of Prineville Railway, and the ability to provide rail service will drive future economic development for Central Oregon. We fully support Connect Oregon 3 program, a Connect Oregon 3 program, and hope Connect Oregon will continue for many years to come. It is great for Oregon and may be the solution for preserving rail service to small shippers in rural areas of Oregon in the future. Thank you, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thanks, Dan. We really appreciate your comments. Questions? I can tell you, panel, that two or three weeks ago, I was over it. It's 64,000 square foot. What, you know, what is... That's big. Let me tell you, it's big. That concrete slab goes forever, it seems like. And the good news was that when they were pouring it, there were 30 people out there working on that project. That's jobs right now that Connects Oregon's doing for our Oregon economy. Dan, again, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I really appreciate everything you do for the Prineville Railroad. Sid, I think you're up.
Thank you. I was told to address Madam Chair first. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee. Unlike Kelly Taylor, I am not a public speaker, nor do I play one on TV. But when I was asked to say a few words about Connect Oregon 2, due to the enormous impact that it has had on the Mount Hood Railroad, I could not refuse. During the flooding of November 2006, a hillside in D. Oregon was washed into the river below, leaving a 200 stretch of track hanging in midair. And I believe you have that picture. I think you've probably all seen it. This event shut down Mount Hood Railroad's operations to Parkdale, Oregon, which is the terminus point of the scenic 21-mile run through the Hood River Valley. The Mount Hood Railroad is a historic monument which has served both freight and commuter needs of the Hood River Valley since 1906. In the last two decades, the Mount Hood Railroad has provided scenic tours to the base of Mount Hood, as well as freight service for the local lumber and fruit industries. It is estimated that through its annual draw of 70-plus thousand riders, the passengers of the Mount Hood Railroad contribute approximately $6 to $7 million annually to the local economy of Hood River County. In addition, the tourist stops at Parkdale are a major economic event for that community. After losing our means to reach Parkdale, attempts were made to create another viable tourist stop. The loss of Parkdale, however, resulted in a steep decline in passenger numbers. It was determined that the future success of Mount Hood Railroad was dependent upon reopening the line to Parkdale. The Mount Hood Railroad could only provide 500,000 of the estimated 1.2 million needed to complete repairs to the line. Connect Oregon 2 provided a grant for nearly $700,000, enabling the repairs that will keep Mount Hood Railroad servicing the freight needs of the Hood River Valley and contributing to the economic well-being of both Hood River and Parkdale communities for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Sid. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
James Schaffler.
My wife and daughter and I rode on that train years ago. I have pictures of Marcella, little girl, and you have an operating switchback on that line,
sir.
Right? And how many are in the country operating? I think there was just like a handful, they said, and that was one of them.
just a handful. I couldn't tell you right now. I've been with the railroad for about 3 years. My background is not railroad, but but I do know it's just a handful.
Yeah, I look forward to riding on it again, though. I'm glad you're still in business.
We do have a dome car now. Let us know. We'll get you a ride on it.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Other questions?
Chair.
Yeah.
Is this the railroad line that you can take that takes you up to the pumpkin patch in the fall for the around the Halloween holiday has the kids train?
Yes, sir.
I took my niece on that last year. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really a nice ride.
The weather cooperated. It could have been very different. Keep your fingers crossed.
Any other questions of Sid? Thank you, panel. I appreciate it very much. I call up Anne-Marie Lundberg and Gary Caldwell. Anne-Marie, you're first.
Well, good afternoon, members of the committee, and thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. Tangent Services is we're a two-person firm and we're a railroad consulting firm, and we specialize in strategic issues, and we have clients throughout the state, including in Medford, the city of Redmond, as well as out in Morrow County. So we feel like we have a good on-the-ground feel for what's happening in the state of Oregon today. It's almost exactly 1 year ago since I addressed the Senate Transportation Committee. And as I said in my report here, what a difference a year makes. At that time, the overriding concern was capacity in all modes of transportation. There was absolutely none of it available, whether you were looking to truck, whether you were looking to air freight, ship by sea or by barge, or certainly by rail. It was all about mainline capacity and mainline velocity. And while our immediate problems are different today, that long-term issue is still going to be in front of us for quite some time. And if anything, what the current economic downturn has done, it's sort of really served to magnify some of the weaknesses that we have in our system here in the state of Oregon. One thing we have going for us is that we have quite an extensive railroad network in the state, and that's unique. Washington is also has a fairly extensive network of short-line railroads, but Oregon really has a lot given the size of the state and the population base that we have here. And that, of course, was driven by the abundant natural resources that we've had for many years, namely the forestry and the agricultural products, as well as a relatively diversified cargo base in the Portland metropolitan area, which is fed by the manufacturing base there as well as by the port activities in that area. So if you look at the state of Oregon, we have a terrific network, one that we really need to work now to shore up and make sure that it works for us well into the future. And then we also have to make sure that the Portland metropolitan area is well taken care of because it is our central hub. And you heard the Class 1 railroads talk earlier about how they really are focusing on taking long trains, albeit a little bit shorter today, but long trains from major hub to major hub. So their overall operating focus is really they want to go Portland to Chicago, Portland to Los Angeles, Portland to New York. That's their gig, and that is how they create efficiencies in their overall operating system. So what happens is we have outlying areas that are served by short-line railroads, and those short lines become ever more critical because the mainline railroads are going to serve Portland to Chicago, and they are not going to stop, for example, in Morrow County to pick up additional rail cars unless there's an operating model in place in Morrow County that's going to fit their operating model. So, Class 1 rail activity, driving efficiencies, and certainly making sure that the Portland hub and their region is taken care of is critical, but we also absolutely need to make sure that our short line network is able to aggregate those volumes for those critical shippers in areas like Medford, Klamath Falls, Morrow County, and so forth. As you heard, they're moving towards unit train configurations, and so in order for these short lines, they have to interchange with the Class 1 railroads at strategic locations that work from a Class 1 operating perspective. And we have to determine where those are and what those look like. I mean, certainly the Portland Western has done so, being the largest operator in the valley and in short line operator in the state. One thing is also that even organizations or agencies or entities that are located shippers, as you heard Representative Schaffler, that if you just have a switch on a mainline railroad today, you're not going to get service. Even with today's lowered volumes, if you have a switch on a main, that particular operating model is going away. It's already been, it's decreased tremendously. We see that in Central Oregon. There are several switches on the main line there. And getting service from the Class 1 carrier for those types of operations are going to be more and more difficult to get. And this is why an operation like the City of Prineville becomes so important, because if you cannot access the Class 1 network directly, how are you going to access it? You can access it by doing a short-haul truck to a facility like the City of Prineville Railroad, who will then aggregate the volumes and then be able to interchange it with that Class 1 operator. That will fit in with their unit train type of operation. They can put together either an entire train, they being the City of Prineville Railway, or they can put together blocks, namely a group of rail cars destined for one location, and again interchange it, fluidly fit in with the Class 1 operating model while still being able to serve the shippers in that region. As you've heard everybody say already, the Connect Oregon program, I think people cannot say enough about it. It's truly a trend-setting type of program, funding program, and while it is and it's beginning to fund many improvements that are needed that you've already heard about: tracks, bridges, tunnels, yards, also all the things that are important for public safety and so on. But what I would encourage you to do is certainly continue that focus on infrastructure and infrastructure funding, but also look at public policies that would identify freight corridors. We know Portland is the hub, but where are the, and I hate to use a modern buzz term, but where are the clusters, the economic clusters in the rest of the state, where we really need to make sure that we've identified that they need to be connected into the Portland hub so they truly can access the national and international network. So we need to look at areas in the state and support those areas to make sure that those economic clusters will thrive and have true modal access moving into the future. As Kelly said earlier, one mode just won't do it. We need modal opportunities for the strategic regions of the state. So we would encourage you to consider a network in the future of many logistics centers, much like the City of Prineville Railway, and see where those are lacking in other parts of the state, and perhaps work through the Connect Oregon to support, as you have done with those, but continue that effort and that drive into the future. I think the other thing I'd like to point out a little bit is that the truck mode, much has been made of this type of relationship, a very antagonistic relationship between truckers and the railroads. Well, while that might still be the case sometimes, the fact is that trucking companies are the number one customer for the Class 1 railroads today. The trucking companies rely on the railroads and vice versa to move their products over long distances. So a Schneider National or one of the big trucking companies will truck to a hub in Portland. That container or that rail trailer will be placed on a rail car and then shipped to Chicago, taken off there, and then trucked to its local destination. So there's quite a symbiotic relationship these days between the railroads and the trucking firms, and I think that's an evolution we can count on continuing to see into the future. So when we look at the trucking, I think what I'm saying in shorthand here is I think that truckers can get on board with this type of project in a lot of ways. They like the short-haul opportunities, and they certainly recognize the long-haul opportunities with the railroads as well. So multimodal logistics centers require the following. They require sufficient developable land, which we all know can come at a premium here in the state of Oregon. They certainly require connectivity to the rail network, accessibility to high-capacity road interchange or freight corridor. And this can be a challenge in some of our rural areas, not so much in the Portland metropolitan area or Salem, but certainly when you get to the outlying areas, we need to make sure that we don't just consider rail, but that road connectivity to any rail-served facility is critical. We have to have zoning that allows for a freight center in a place that makes sense. We have to have infrastructure on the railroad main line that's conducive to this unit train activity. So you can't just look at the facility itself in isolation. You have to look at the rail network that feeds that particular facility and make sure there's siding capacity and or yard capacity. I know in Redmond, for example, you have three road crossings that go through the main yard that switches out a facility there. Not ideal. So you have to have infrastructure that's conducive to this type of activity. And another thing that we need, and I know that the Oregon Freight Planning Effort is working on this, is that we need solid market data that shows total freight movements. I think people tend to isolate, okay, these are rail movements and these are truck movements, and they look at them in isolation, whereas oftentimes, if you could just convert 5% of the current product that's trucked, convert that to rail, you'd make a significant impact both in the business cases for these struggling short lines. You would also make a significant environmental contribution, and also a fairly significant reduction in your road activities in a fairly congested areas. So I think that data would be critical. Anyway, as you've heard already, efficient transportation is key to the retention of existing jobs and creation of new jobs. Oregon has a well-developed rail network. The challenge is now to make strategic investments, not just in the infrastructure, but also in facilities to foster development of new business and make the rail network financially and operationally sustainable into the future. And with that, I thank you again and would be happy to answer any questions.
Committee, we're going to have to give Mr. Cardwell a chance to talk, so we'll get kicked out of here probably in about 6 or 7 minutes. I apologize for that.
Okay, I'll be quick. I'm not sure how to do this.
It's three slides a minute.
It'll be 10 slides a minute. Okay. Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, thank you for having me here today. My name is Gary Cardwell, and this is going to do that thing. I'm the Divisional Vice President for Northwest Container. We are a short-haul rail provider. What we do is subcontract with the Class 1s to hook and haul from our facilities to our facilities with our rail cars. So what we do is we typically contract with the shipper or the steamship line to move international freight from Portland to Tacoma, Seattle, or from Seattle, Tacoma into Portland. And we'll get into a little bit further where we're branching out to Boardman this year through the help of the Connect Oregon 2 funds. Again, we're primarily an international mover of freight. In November of 2004, we were acquired by Waste Connections. And our goal now is to move both solid waste and international on the same train. We'll put the solid waste behind the international freight, so downwind. we provide a wide range of services from chassis inspection, container inspection, repair of those, container and chassis storage, again, rail and truck logistics as well. And our marketplace is typically less than 200 miles. We've got the fourth largest privately owned facility, 80 acres in Portland. The Boardman facility, we were successful through Connect Oregon 2 for a $10 million grant out there with the Port of Morrow. We've selected an engineer. We should be breaking ground on that in June, July, and we should be up and running by November or December of this year. There's the hay shippers and straw shippers and whatnot. There's about 150 international containers a year out there. And our landfill, Findlay Buttes Landfill, is about 5 miles down the road where we're planning on railing solid waste. We've got, we'd like to get down to Lebanon, Eugene. We've picked out a site actually in Lebanon that's about 100 yards from the Lowe's distribution center. And Lowe's is very interested in having us rail their product from Seattle, Tacoma, Portland to Lebanon. 2 years ago, they anticipated about 250 containers a week. Unfortunately, that's in this economy, it's down to about 70. It never really peaked. Just as that started to go online, the economy and the housing market started to teeter off as well. We run 5 to 6 trains a week between Portland and Seattle. In Portland, we pick up Halfback Lloyd, which is a steamship line. They bring in Starbucks coffee, Italian wines, olive, marble, things like that that we rail up to Seattle. And we do some the K-Line and the Costco Hanjin business as well. We typically average about 60,000 containers a year. In 2005, we actually hit about 85,000 containers. October of 2008, however, fell off the cliff. There was almost no import Christmas season. And since then, it's really been down. My projections for 2009 is we'd be lucky to do 45,000 containers this year. Majority of that is imports. So when we're not buying, consuming the clothing, the Nike sneakers, the Columbia sportswear, the Les Schwab tires, the high-tech goods like that aren't coming in. Those repositioned containers that came down as an import then get used as an Oregon export. Oregon has three exports for every one import. So we're starting to get into a real problem where we're not consuming and generating those imports, and now we've got Oregon exporters scrambling for containers to go out with the hay, the straw, the building materials. We do about 400 containers of Christmas trees every winter to Hawaii, which is a fun part of our year. But a majority of it is the hay and the straw business out of the valley. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, China, even for that matter, consume a lot of the grass seed straw that has more nutritional value than the rice seed straw. And they don't have enough to feed their from racehorses to cows for milk and dairy products. So it's a billion-dollar business to Oregon in that. Refrigerated goods as well. Primarily, we are exports north, imports south. Exports in Oregon are typically over 60,000 pounds. That's due, you know, so what they get is one-third more weight into a container than on an import. So when you're importing clothes at 40,000 pounds, you're able to export agricultural product at 60,000 pounds. When you pay the steamship line, you pay them by the container, not by the weight. So there's a huge advantage for them to cube out that container with hay and straw and product. We provide a pier-to-terminal service or a pier-to-door service, depending on what the steamship line would like or the shipper would like. Out of Willamette Valley, so there's nuts and grass seed and grass seed straw. Central Valley is typically timothy, alfalfa. Out of the Dalles is the fruits and the berries and the things in refrigerated containers. And then out of the Boardman, Humatilla, Hermanston area, again, is the timothy, alfalfa, onions, and processed potatoes. A lot of French fries are shipped out of the Oregon area through Lamb Center. I think it's called ConAgra now that recently acquired them. We employ about 100 people. Unfortunately, I've cut down about 10% of that in the last 3 months. Like I said, at first it was just let's hunker down, and now it's let's stay alive, because with no imports and no empties available for those exports, it's really starting to drop capacity. So I'm not sure we've even bottomed out yet. I was talking to a steamship line the other day that moves containers of retrofits for Toyota and Honda. So when the car comes over and you want to change a CD or the leather seats, they think they have 6 to 9 months worth of capacity sitting in the U.S. in containers ready to go in the cars that aren't being purchased. So the Port of Portland, for instance, typically leases out 5 acres for auto parking. It's now up to 40 acres. Cars are parked everywhere. Again, we've got an 80-acre facility in Portland. We work with the Port of Portland as well, where we help support the steamship lines that come in through there. We've got 2 facilities in Seattle. Seattle is still staying alive. Tacoma is, we've got a facility in Tacoma. The port of Tacoma is starting to fall. There are more and more ships actually just being dry docked. From what I've heard, there's well over 100 ships just parked at sea outside the U.S. Because there just isn't that import-export volume anymore that there was just 12 months ago, 6 months ago. the Port of Morrow. Thank you for the Connect Oregon funds for that. We're really excited. Again, the engineer has been selected. They're going to get into the detailed design. We've got approval from the UP to start moving forward on that. They've got to bless the final design. And again, we hope to break ground in June, July for that and be up and running by the end of the year. There's still a lot of the fixed hay, straw, and whatnot product out in that area. And then the solid waste we're counting on as well. And again, we're eventually looking at branching down to Lebanon. So our goal kind of eventually is if we can get down to Lebanon, we can actually connect the short lines to Portland. So we could connect the Corp, the Albany Eastern, the Portland Western, could bring their trains into our facility that could connect there and then be railed into Portland and then taken out. So if we could do that, we could literally connect from Portland to Coos Bay to Cave Falls. And we could do all that by rail, which helps relieve a lot of traffic on our highways.
Mr. Cartswell, we have a committee chair from the next committee coming in, so
sure.
If you kind of want to finish with your last words. And
I love the room.
Oh, okay. Well, so maybe he's not going to taste that yet.
We've invested about almost $50 million into this since I've been there in 1997. We're excited about Connect Oregon, Connect Oregon 2, Connect Oregon 3. The railroads can really need it. The condition of the system out there needs a lot of work, and we need your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, thank everybody for coming. We really appreciate it. And sorry to rush you there at the end.
Not a problem.
And we are adjourned. Have a good weekend.